This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And online at aladdin-theater.com.
On the anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, we hear about an environmental watchdog group about the Hanford nuclear site.
And former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick is convicted of corruption charges.
We didn't test mics today.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 11th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. International longshore and warehouse union workers have been locked out of work at Mitsui United Grain since the end of February. Several hundred people rallied Friday morning at Esther Short Park in support of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU. KBOO's Jamie Partridge reports.
Jamie Partridge with the KBOO News. We're here at Esther Short Park in Vancouver, Washington. For the first time in 80 years, longshore is not loading grain. The grain is being loaded by scabs, non-union workers. This is what's going on. Now, why are you here today? Bill Zimmerman, president of Local 206 Teamster.
Well, we're here in support of our brothers and sisters. All too often, I don't think employers get the word solidarity or brotherhood and sisterhood. And so we just thought we'd show up today and to show our support. All too often we take it, and I think we're just tired of it. We want to get active, and we want to make sure that employers and even our Congress people know that we're just working folks, and all we want is what's fair. That's all we're asking here, what's fair. And that's about it. That's why.
They want to take our union protection, and that's it. Eliminate our voice in the workplace. And we're here to show them we're not going to let that happen. We don't care how long, we're going to win this struggle. And we're doing everything we can to get back in there. And it's time for these foreign corporations to stop the attack on unions and working families in this country, and especially right here on our docks. The American companies, Cargill, they came to an agreement with us, but the Japanese companies and the French company, they don't want any part of it. They want to fight us. We'll fight. It's time for everybody to wake up and see what's going on. Nobody cares that unemployment was almost 10% in this county when they brought in visa workers to do a concrete pour to build that thing, 200 of them, because nobody knew how to do that. We watched it being built. I'm pretty sure we could have found somebody to shovel spilled concrete into the form as it was going up. Masons would have, I think they could have handled that. Okay, next we have Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council. Come on up, Jeff.
Brothers and sisters, it's so good to be here with you today. My name's Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council, AFL-CIO. And on behalf of over 450,000 union members in the state of Washington, we got a clear message for Mitsui United Grain. End this illegal lockout now! Yeah. Now, I want to ask you this. I don't know what it is about these multinational grain companies down here, but they don't seem to get us. What's the deal? We had a little issue, going back 18 months ago with EGT, just up the road a little bit, right? And here it is again. We want some understanding from them that they have an understanding of our history and our culture, just an inkling of it, right? Because labor, unions in the state of Washington, we are deep-rooted in this state, right? We are over 500,000 strong in the state of Washington, right? And we live by the basic values of the ILWU, An injury to one is an injury to all.
ILWU!
Is a fair contract that we negotiated with Cargill. They sat down. They weren't under any pressure to give us a contract. We sat down with Cargill, an American-owned company, and we came up with an agreement. In the newspaper, they say, oh, but we don't have the contract. Well, let me tell you what we're going to do. We're going to march up the street to UGC's office, and I'm going to hand them the contract.
Right here in front of the Riverview Tower, which is the corporate headquarters of the Mitsui United Grain. And that was Bob McAlrath, the president of the International Longshore Union. He's walking to the front door, escorted by several longshoremen, to deliver the contract that was signed by Cargill Temco Company just last week to demonstrate that Mitsui United Grain has an alternative to negotiate a fair contract.
Shocking. Let them in! Let them in!
That was KBOO's Jamie Partridge at a rally held Friday in solidarity for ILWU members currently locked out of work.
Today, the Portland Jobs with Justice Workers' Right Board issued a 14-page report detailing the problems faced by temporary workers in the metro area. The report goes over facts from a hearing, which featured testimony from workers throughout the Portland Metro and Bureau of Parks and Recreation. These two city departments together employ about 4,000 temporary employees. According to the report, the biggest concerns faced by temporary workers are a lack of employment security, including no opportunities for advancement, and a limited ability to raise issues and complaints. Temporary city employees are limited to 1,400 hours per year without vacation, sick leave, or eligibility for health benefits. Many of these workers consider the positions to be misclassified as temporary when the need for the jobs is clearly year-round. Mary King, economics professor from Portland State University, commented that workers are paid considerably less than comparably qualified permanent or full-time employees, and this has an impact on the broader economy. The report concludes with a 5-point recommendation to the city and metro, and also recommends that the labor union start an educational campaign to garner support for full-time employees.
A campaign for immigrant rights has been organized by Causa Oregon and the Rural Organization Project. Its last demonstration was held today in Bend, Oregon, due to several fires that were set at and around the Episcopal Trinity Church, who acted as host to kick the event off on March 5th. Police are still investigating, but said they believe all 7 fires were set by the same person or group. As of yet, the arsons are not being viewed as a hate crime. KBOO's Robin Ryan discussed the event and the implications of the crime that followed with Greg Delgado, organizer for Causa Oregon.
Can you talk about the event that your group held last week in Bend?
We had a March for One Oregon that we did a kickoff by starting with a letter-writing campaign early in the morning at 10 o'clock at the Social Justice Center in Bend. Then we marched to Walden's office, dropped off some letters, continued the march to Trinity Episcopal Church, where we had a send-off with prayers, an Aztec dance prayer, and local Christian community fellows came in and helped us with other prayers, a luncheon, and then we told some very powerful stories of local Latinos that are affected by this issue. And then we all boarded the bus and moved on to Madras and did an event there as well.
How many days and how many cities did the event cover?
We did 5 days, and we covered countless cities. I would say we did at least 2 a day, 2 or 4, about 10 cities. Yeah. We went. I can tell you the route pretty much. We went from Bend to Madras to Hood River to Ontario, LeGrand, Ontario, and then we went to Nampa, Idaho, and then Burley, Idaho, and then back to Walla Walla. And then we ended the trip. We came back for the peace vigil at Trinity because of the tragedy there. We came back and united with the church in prayer.
What happened to the venue of your kickoff event later that night?
What we know so far is that afternoon we did the kickoff. Great press all over the news on that because all the media, the local media, was out there. That night somewhere around 2 o'clock, somebody or some person started a fire at that church. There are two buildings right next to each other owned by this church, and down an alley, several garages and automobiles were damaged and burned as well. They went on a burning spree and burnt the church and some other buildings around there.
Do you have any feel for what the status of the investigation is?
Well, they're looking into everything. We know the FBI was investigating. Local authorities are announcing every day on the television if anybody has any information, they have a reward pending. They're not pointing out any that it may be related to our march, but there's no evidence pointing to anything at this point.
Do you feel like the arsons may have been a response to your event?
I hate to think so. I really do. It saddens me. It breaks my heart to think that this kind of hate still exists in our communities, especially in this community where we worked so hard to build a very strong community together, that one random act of violence like this could really, really actually happen and be related to some sort of hate. But I really cannot speculate on that. My heart is saying, please don't say that until we know for sure. But, you know, when we have a community that lives in fear because of this immigration issue, this is just going to make that matter worse if that was the case. So that's what we look at.
Well, I certainly want to end our discussion on a positive note. How many people participated in the march?
Oh, the march was amazing. We did the march here with about 100 people at the march that all with drums and picket signs and everything. And we went to the church and all sat there and had a great spiritual kind of conversation around what immigration was about and how it affected our community, and some pozole, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful trip. Everywhere we went, we were well received with open arms and people eager all over the state to work on this issue. CAUSA Oregon is who I work for, and ROP, Rural Organizing Project, we did this together for March for One Oregon was the name of the campaign, and it was very exciting. We met with a bus from Washington. There's a total of 18 buses all over the nation called Keeping Families Together campaign that they launched buses all this week. And the message was that immigration affects all our communities, and many communities are not being heard or even outreached about what this issue of immigration looks like in their communities. This was a nationwide campaign with some huge success. We're very excited and honored to be a part of it. You can go to the CAUSA website at causaoregon.org. We have lots of events going on. We're having our lobby days in Salem. We're going to be doing a May Day rally. We expect huge numbers at that. That'll be fun. Well, we're going to be really asking for the in-state driver's license and immigration reform. Both of those are the number one agendas for ROP and CAUSA's campaign work. So we look forward to having everybody in Salem and joining us at that rally and telling the Capitol and telling our leaders that they need to make changes that work for our communities.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Today marks the second anniversary of the 9-point magnitude earthquake and resulting tsunami that struck Japan in 2011, killing over 18,000 people. Power was knocked out at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility, causing a meltdown that resulted in the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl, as nuclear waste leaked into the Pacific Ocean and fallout reached the west coast of the United States. The Northwest has its own precarious nuclear facility, the Hanford Site, a decommissioned nuclear weapons facility and waste dump near Richland, Washington. Recent reports confirmed that nuclear waste is leaking from the site. Hanford, which houses hundreds of millions of gallons of nuclear waste, is also situated on a fault area, which makes it especially susceptible to earthquake damage. KBOO's Mike Klepfer talked to Tom Carpenter of watchdog group Hanford Challenge on the threat posed by the site.
Could you explain the Hanford nuclear site and the danger it poses?
The Hanford nuclear site is a former plutonium production site that made the plutonium for America's nuclear arsenal, including for the bomb that was dropped over Nagasaki. It's no longer making plutonium. However, it is now the site of a large legacy of nuclear materials left over from 45 years of production. Much of that is stored in underground tanks that were built to last about 20 years. Many of these tanks were built in the 1940s and 50s, and clearly, they're no longer considered viable tanks. About a third of these have leaked already, and six are actively leaking.
So the efforts to clean up the Hanford site have been decades in the making, and they've come with their share of problems. Can you explain the relationship the government has taken in terms of cleaning up the Hanford site?
Sure. The government is represented at the Hanford site by the U.S. Department of Energy, and it used to be called the Atomic Energy Commission. And the site was operated in secrecy for most of its all of its production cycle, and it's kept a lot of those habits up to today, even though we've been in cleanup since 1989. The government actually hires contractors to perform the cleanup mission, and the contractors tend to come and go a lot. About every 5 to 10 years, there's a new set of contractors out there, except for the large facility that they're building that's meant to glassify or vitrify the nuclear waste in the tank. And that's called the waste treatment plant. And that's been the same contractor for the last 13 years, which is the Bechtel National Company.
Bechtel's been criticized. Last year they were deemed incompetent by a leaked Department of Energy memo. What has Bechtel done, and what haven't they done?
Well, Bechtel was hired to construct the waste treatment plant, which is actually 4 separate nuclear facilities. The plant is in big trouble. It's got large cost overruns. It's got significant schedule delays. The government has done studies of this, and the Department of Energy and other groups have come in and accused them of mismanagement, of incompetence. The chief engineer for nuclear safety for the Department of Energy called for some of their responsibilities to be taken away, and yet they're still there.
Hanford is positioned on the Columbia River. It's in Richland, Washington. What are some of the dangers if the Hanford nuclear site should leak into the Columbia River?
Well, obviously, it's bad news for those people who are downstream. That includes all the communities between where Hanford is, about 200 miles upstream, and Portland. The radioactive materials that are subject to leaking into the Columbia River, many of them are bioconcentrators, meaning that strontium 90 and cesium, for instance, act like elements that we're used to taking into our bodies, like calcium or potassium. The danger level for strontium 90 is a trillionth of a curie, and yet they've got many tens of millions of curies of this stuff in the tanks out there at Hanford. So it would be a very severe consequence to the environment and to the human health and safety if material were to reach the river. And some is already hitting the river.
All right, Tom, thank you very much for talking to me.
Oh, sure.
That was KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaking with Tom Carpenter of the watchdog group Hanford Challenge.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. In tonight's show, we hear about one block in Chicago with the highest number of incarcerations in the whole city. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be cloudy and warm, highs around 62 degrees. It should cool to about 49 in the evening, with a chance of rain.
It's 5:21, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The word of the day is boom. Yes, boom times are upon us again. The stars came into alignment, marveled one financial manager. Corporate confidence returns, applauded a recent headline. We're finally dusting off the cobwebs, rejoiced a business analyst, pointing out that banks are willing to take risks. Well, it's about time that bankers and CEOs began turning loose of some of the trillions of dollars they've been hoarding. Since the crash of 2008, grassroots America has been starved of investment and job-creating enterprises. So any sign of that long-dormant capital finally beginning to move would be splendid news indeed. Except for this nagging question. Where's the money going? Hint, not to you. The big money is not being invested in job growth, grassroots enterprise, new products, or anything else that would improve your family's economic prospects. Rather, this boom is truly explosive, a job-destroying financial flimflam known grandly as the corporate merger. It amounts to nothing more than one giant corporation taking over another, or even a corporation taking over itself. The mega merger is back, exclaimed the New York Times. I'll say, already this year, $11 billion was spent to merge U.S. Air into American Airlines. Warren Buffett and a Brazilian buyout group threw $23 billion into the purchase of ketchup peddler H.J. Heinz. And Michael Dell amassed $24 billion to buy his namesake computer outfit, which he already was in charge of and owned the biggest chunk of. This is Jim Hightower saying, this buyout boom is a boon to the financial hucksters and top executives who profit from the deals, but merger mania cuts jobs, shrinks competition, raises consumer prices, concentrates wealth in fewer hands, and diverts capital from productive enterprises. What a deal for America!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Settlements between failed banks and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, have increasingly been kept out of the headlines. The FDIC is the government corporation that insures money saved in banks. The FDIC pursued punitive damages from failed banks to help cover its losses, as well as restore public confidence that banks were being held responsible following the savings and loans crisis in the early 90s. The FDIC Improvement Act of 1991 was also a result of that crisis. It includes a ban on keeping settlements confidential. In 2008, the FDIC has adopted a much lower profile in response to the mortgage crisis. The new approach includes settling for a fraction of its losses and goes as far as signing a no-press release agreement with banks. An attorney who worked on the 1991 legislation says it does not require the FDIC to call attention to large settlements, but the no-press release agreement violates the, quote, spirit of the law. In these agreements, the FDIC promises not to reach out to the media following a settlement. However, they cannot legally keep the settlements a secret and must answer questions when asked. Between 2007 and 2012, 471 U.S. banks have failed. In that time, the FDIC has paid out over $90 billion, nearly depleting its deposit insurance fund and collecting less than $1 billion in settlements with banks.
The buzzword in Washington for the last 2 weeks has been budget sequestration, across-the-board cuts to virtually every government program. But one project that remains immune to cuts of any kind is the controversial F-35 jet fighter program. With a budget of $1 trillion, it's the most expensive weapons program in U.S. history. But a new report obtained from the Pentagon shows that every single one of the new fighter jets has major flaws, rendering them entirely unusable. The Project on Government Oversight managed to leak a copy of the report, which was dated February 15th. Even though the F-35 airplanes only engaged in limited testing, 9 planes had critical flaws. Some pilots complained about not being able to see out of the cockpit. And the plane's main contractor, Lockheed Martin, failed to provide replacement parts for the F-35 jets. Despite the multiple serious problems, the trillion-dollar weapons project has retained its complete funding from Congress.
Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was convicted this morning of corruption charges. Jurors finished their 2-week deliberations on Friday, but took the weekend to sleep on it before announcing their decision today. He was found guilty on 24 charges, which include racketeering and extortion, each of which carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. Prosecutors say Kilpatrick ran the city as a, quote, private profit machine. One of Kilpatrick's co-conspirators, Bobby Ferguson, was also convicted of racketeering. Evidence was presented to show Kilpatrick's received kickbacks from $84 million worth of municipal contracts he directed to Ferguson's excavating company. Kilpatrick was also accused of using campaign contributions and money intended for his charity, the Kilpatrick Civic Fund, for personal expenses. Kilpatrick was Detroit's mayor from 2001 until he resigned in 2008 after pleading guilty to obstruction of justice charges. The 2008 charges came about after a text message scandal surrounding his affair with the chief of staff. proving he had lied about the relationship under oath in an unrelated lawsuit.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, March 11, 2013. Palestinian child injured by an Israeli settler in Jerusalem and Israeli tanks invade parts of Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian child was injured on Monday afternoon when she was hit by an Israeli settler's car in occupied East Jerusalem. 9-year-old Nadine Jalius was walking home from her school when a settler hit her with his car and fled the scene, eyewitnesses told local news. Medical sources in Jerusalem Makassid's hospital announced that the child sustained moderate wounds and is in stable condition. In other news, Israeli troops kidnapped on Monday morning 6 Palestinian men during invasions targeting a number of villages around the southern West Bank city of Hebron. One man was arrested when troops searched and ransacked homes in the village of Beni Noaim. Another 4 were taken during invasion targeting the village of Beit Ula, and one more man was taken from his home at Al-Arub refugee camp near Hebron. Earlier on Sunday night near Hebron, a number of extremist Israeli settlers of the Ma'on illegal settlement built on Palestinian lands that belongs to residents of Yatta town south of Hebron hurled stones at Palestinian cars, causing excessive damage but no injuries. In Gaza today, a number of armored Israeli military vehicles carried out a limited invasion in an area east of Johar ad-Dik area south of Gaza City. Local sources reported that the army, stationed in a military base near the border, advanced 200 meters into the area while army bulldozers leveled and uprooted Palestinian farmlands and property. The army withdrew from the area later on. No clashes or confrontation have been reported. Also in Gaza, Israel decided on Monday to allow 2 trucks filled with Gaza-made wooden furniture to be exported through the Kerem Abu Salem, Kerem Shalom crossing in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, in addition to allowing the entry of 350 trucks filled with supplies for trade, agriculture and transportation sectors. 19 of those trucks are loaded with cement, iron and gravel and are meant to be used for the implementation of international development projects. Limited amounts of cooking gas have also been allowed into the coastal region today as well. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 11th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Bassam Bandura.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Matt Maddox, Robin Ryan, and Mike Klepfer. The producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to reporters Jamie Partridge, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the guest is Metro Councilor Bob Stacey, who will talk about the Columbia River crossing.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, we hear the late historian and activist Howard Zinn speaking on Against War. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11, it's On Stage and Studio. Host D-May Roberts talks with dancer and musician Michelle Fuji, the artistic director of Portland Tyco, about their new spring concert, Insatiable. And we hear D-May's feature story about New Zealand's Black Grace dance. At 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan talks to abstract painter Deborah Gillis about her show of recent paintings at Butter's Gallery and the relationship between landscape and abstract elements in her work. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 11th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, on the two-year anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and tsunami, scrutiny continues to fall on nuclear power in the U.S., and environmental advocates call for a break to renewable resources. U.S. and Afghan officials clash over the role of U.S. Special Forces in Wardak Province. And in California, residents raise concerns about the controversial practice of hydraulic fracturing in the state.